Welcome to the Azzy Podcast. I'm your host, Justin McRoberts. This is going to be a look back at season three, a season that I think was our richest, deepest, and most apocalyptic season to date. Before we get into that review, I'd like to remind us why we're here to begin with. My intention with the podcast was to look for and look at what comes next when it comes to the practice and expression of faith, and that we do so by highlighting the works of the women and men who are actively building into what comes next. That effort, that search, and those questions, those conversations, I think they matter more now than when we started. I hope and I believe you feel that too, so join me in propelling and shaping that conversation. Join me in lifting that conversation up a bit so that those who aren't paying attention quite yet can hear it, can come close and be changed by it. Jump to patreon.com/JustinMcRoberts and join this effort. Season 3 began in conversation with author and activist Dominique Dubois-Jullard, who invited us behind the bars and the walls of the prison system to consider what justice looks like for persons of color and what justice ought to look like for persons of faith. Check it out.
Evangelicals historically have fail to have any kind of true engagement and theological understanding of systemic sin. All sin is about individual sin.
Yes.
And when all sin is about individual sin, then you can do what you just said earlier about distance yourself from the henchmen because you're not the person stringing somebody up.
Yep.
But then you can also distance yourself from the legacy of racism in this nation. I didn't own slaves. I didn't lynch anybody. I wasn't keeping anybody.
Which is how that's how the conversation goes almost every time now, right? Yeah. It's like, but I've got a great relationship with my Chinese neighbor.
And I go to a multi-ethnic church.
Yes.
And
I'm taking care of my business.
Exactly. And that's just such a flawed understanding of race, but also understanding of what our call is as the church, as people who are called to live in the world, but not of the world, but distinctively set apart in a way in which we embody the countercultural nature that Jesus did and Jesus is like that.
Dominique then advocated for an appreciation of various modes of activism, from the more radical expressions that often make the news, to his preference for slower, more institutionally focused efforts.
I mean, the truth is you always need the Martin and the Malcolm. Neither is effective without the other. I feel called to the institutional role in large part because I believe that there is a lot more transformation that can happen in the context of relationships, authentic relationships. And I think that there are a lot of well-intentioned people who are in positions of power who don't have enough proximate relationships to suffering. And in the midst of me being present, I think I bring a different dimension to boardrooms, to denominational meetings. I think I bring a different relational capital to those places in which I can steward my relationships for justice. I can steward my relationships in a way that broker different conversations, in a way that brings a kind of humanity to the suffering of people that issues no longer remain issues, but they are connected to bodies, to people, to stories, to relationships.
That's good.
And I think those relationships that are really what brings true institutional transformation.
We spoke with songwriter Sandra McCracken about creativity and family and community, and eventually gravitated towards a theme that this podcast comes back to over and over and over. Home.
I think home is people. Like, home is like a, you know, kind of having this nucleus of family and belonging that sometimes, you know, it's actual, you know, blood relationships, you know, like our family. But then in other ways, I think it's the connection, kind of that mystic connection that we have through people that God binds us up in life with. And, you know, we have to build toward that and strengthen those, the fabric of our lives together, which, but I think that's what creates home.
Author, speaker, and hope slinger, Carlos Whitaker offered us a look at the heart of his most recent book, Kill the Spider. A challenge to us that we might face our fears as defining and refining moments rather than obstacles to a full life.
I had to undo everything I learned in church. I did. I finally realized that I had come to a semblance where I had created an entire faith based on sermons that I had listened to and not based on what God had specifically told me. Yeah. And man, that was a frightening space to stand in. It was a very sobering, scary place, but gosh, what a freeing space to be able to stand in once I did that. It was scary to get there, but yeah, I mean, I had to unravel my belief system. I had to unravel everything. I mean, I had to start asking the simple, basic questions of, okay, I know that Andy Stanley preached this amazing message on the Christmas story, but do I really believe that?
Yeah. You
know, do I, at the end of the day, is this something that I'm willing to wrestle with? And so, yeah, I've spent a lot of years, specifically one strategic week at a experiential therapy center,
right,
an hour outside of Nashville, that really helped me do that and helped me kind of identify a lot of the lies that I'd been believing and step into some truths.
I talked with photographer and storyteller Jeremy Cowart about his career as a creative and the potential threat of exploitation that comes when human life is your subject matter.
I'm just very aware of the idea that I could be exploiting people. So it's always the first question I'm asking, how do I go into this situation not to exploit people? And even with the best intentions, a lot of times people think you are still there just to exploit them and take advantage of them. And so it's all about, you know, communication and walking up to people without a camera and just talking to them and getting to know them first, you know, putting the cameras away and just being, you know, just loving people, just being honest and real. And, you know, if somebody walked up in my backyard with a camera, I'd be pretty freaked out too.
Right.
You
know? Yes.
Get off my lawn is what I'd be saying. But
yeah,
you know, so you have to really approach people with the soft listening heart for sure.
Michael McBride returned to the podcast to lead us a few steps deeper into the role of the church in the age of Donald Trump, an age in which crossing the line between political and religious isn't just unavoidable, it's necessary.
I think the role of the church within empire is to be the prophet, to be the conscience, to always call the country back to right relationship, repentance, but more faithful stewardship. It is not to help make theological sense of mass murder. And so I think we've lost a lot, man. And it's not, I mean, it's pronounced under certain, to your point, it's more pronounced under certain regimes than other. I mean, I think, you know, it would be, you know, kind of irresponsible or, you know, somewhat a thin analysis to suggest that all presidents and administrations and political kind of philosophies are equal when we think of the kind of loss of life and oppression of people that results from said policies. But I think it's important to just be truthful that empires rarely are liberating. They depend on power. They depend on violence to help solidify power. They depend on death or the fear of death to maintain order. And that is an antithesis to the message of Jesus.
I sat down with Matt Shotwell to talk about the human shape of the often divisive and confusing world of the marijuana industry, including the people he's served, he's helped, and those he's employed.
Squeeze was on the street in downtown Vallejo. Mauricio Rodriguez, for all you local Vallejos that know, but he was my squeeze. Yeah, he was homeless, no job, on the street, and I opened up my dispensary on 717 Marin Street, and every space vacant and empty, and I started selling weed out of my dispensary. And he was selling weed on the street too, and so we became friends and chatted. I needed a security guard, and he needed a job, and so it was kind of like, let's join forces. You know everybody on the street, so protect me, I will pay you.
Yeah.
Don't sell weed to them, sell it through here. Funnel teacher, we had a little joining of forces down there, and then I hired another one, and I hired some friends, and all of these people, that gravitated towards that little business that I created, and this little cash cow was making money and paying people, and it transformed the internal finances of people's homes and lives for several years until tragedy happens. You lose a grow, you lose a business, you go to jail, Matt goes to jail, the business gets shut down and moved, and it would upset and destroy people's lives too. And that really pissed me off as a business person and entrepreneur. I'm like, I built something, I made something, I gave all these people jobs, they love it. What the fuck are you doing tipping this over for? And it's legal and you're interpreting this in a different way. Yeah. And it infuriated me, and it made me out and lash out at the city in some narratives that I kind of regret doing and saying. But I was pissed, and I was immature, and I was a new businessman and trying to do a good thing, and we were all trying to figure out a weird illegal business. But literally cannabis and the finances of were and are and will always be changing people's lives, and it pissed people off. There's power grabs of other people, like, oh wait, all these poor people of color all have money now, they're all growing weed, and I sell t-shirts and jewelry, and I'm mad about it. I sell barbecue chicken, and I'm mad about it. And all these neighboring businesses see my business thriving, and they see me as a drug dealer, and they're pissed about it. But yet, look at all the people that are getting paid. They didn't even have a job, and now we had 30 dispensaries here in the city at one time. 30. And all of them having 5 to 10 employees each.
Scott Erickson, with whom I created the book Prayer, 40 Days of Practice, mused beautifully on the nature of religious culture, both in language and in imagery.
Most of these subject matters like forgiveness, grace, love, were taught to me and talked about to me in the context of religion. So I just always assigned it as these are religious words. Hmm. And then I started realizing, oh no, it's kind of like what we do with the prayer book. We're like, we pray because we're human, not because we're religious. Right, religion helps giving a form to prayer, but prayer is a human activity. Same thing. Like, love is a human activity. Grace is a human activity. Forgiveness is a human activity. Oh, actually, everything in religion is a human activity. Would I have a quote from Henry Nouwen? Somebody wrote this and they gave it to me. In solitude, we realize that nothing human is alien to us. Like, it's just like, oh, it's all about being human.
Right.
And we don't own the rights to human. Like, a religion doesn't own the rights to human things.
I spoke with author and journalist Jonathan Merritt about the focus of his most recent book, Learning to Speak God from Scratch, a kind of reimagining and redefining of the words that shape the way we see and talk about not just divine things, but our neighbor as well.
Thanks to the internet, we're all engaging with people all the time.
Right.
And we're engaging with people who differ from us in race and religion and socioeconomic status and cultural mores and gender identity and sexual orientation. And when we're in spaces like that and we're undressed rhetorically, we start to realize, yeah, I don't actually know what I'm saying when I'm saying what I'm saying.
Right.
Well, when that happens, we just stop talking about it altogether. Yeah. And here I was, a faith and culture writer in New York City, thinking I was going to conquer the iron wilderness with my faith, and realized I was totally helpless. I could no longer speak God.
In that conversation with Jonathan, we dove down into a few of the words that don't just change, but in fact degrade the way we see our world, including the word broken.
You know, you have a lot of people out there, particularly straight Western conservative Christians, who they still believe that if a person is, quote, gay, well, then you just can do something to manipulate the system and you flip the light switch and now you're straight. The funny thing is if I ask that same person, well, what could I do to flip your switch and make you gay? They would say nothing.
Right.
Which is always so weird and fascinating. Like, okay, so the switch only works when it's somebody who you don't like or you don't know or you don't understand.
Somebody who's broken.
Yeah, somebody who is, quote, broken.
Right.
So what I say is that that word broken assumes something, particularly that whatever is, quote, broken can be fixed. And that just doesn't apply to many of these situations in which we've used it. And so as a result, it becomes harmful because it actually goes from an adjective to a noun. Hmm. Not this thing outside of me I describe as broken, but it is me. It is the essence of me. I am broken. Mm. And so there's no wonder why the various groups that we've used this term with impunity to describe them often saturate our churches with their absence.
Season 3 came to a close with two conversations around culturally and politically historic moments. The first was the death of Christian missionary John Chow, who was killed while trying to gain access to one of the world's most isolated people groups. The moment begged a series of questions about evangelism and pluralism. We talked to author Matt Michelotos about both those things.
You can go to the middle of nowhere in Africa and find a tiny little white church with a chapel steeple there that looks like it's from Missouri.
Yeah.
And that's evidence. That's absolutely where the church and colonialism were connected. And there's reasons for this, right? It's because church people, religious people who think that there's an eternal reason to get to people who don't know about Jesus are willing to make a lot of sacrifice. And I would put John Chow in that, right in that category. That's what he's thinking. That's why he's doing it. If we presume the best about his motivations, right?
Right.
Not knowing him. But what happened was, who else is willing to be there on the front lines risking everything is people who want to make money or governments who want more power. So a lot of times Christians would be the first in somewhere or very close to the first, and right next to them, like as soon as it was marginally safer, would be representatives of various government organizations. And you look back at, I mean, you don't have to look back far. You look at the history of Hawaii, for instance.
Yes.
And you see where Christians have been part of the laying the groundwork for really horrific things that came afterwards from various governments and other organizations. Sometimes we're working as translators, sometimes ended up as part of the government, you know, things like that. So I think one of the major shifts has been that all of these missions organizations have looked at that, and I'm not saying it's completely done away with, but we've said, how do we go and not make a Missouri church in Africa? How do we make a church that actually is, what does it mean for an African person to follow Jesus well? And does that look the same as someone from Missouri following Jesus well? And I think it's a really important question because when it comes as we're growing in our cultural understanding, what is culture? How does it work? Did God create culture? You know, and if so, doesn't that mean it's good? And we don't need to subvert someone's culture for them to follow Christ.
Finally, Jared Swigert from the Global Immersion Project guided us over the wall of noise and agenda into the real life stories of women and men at the southern border of the United States.
We're working with faith leaders. We're working with the city planners of Tijuana. We're working with the university system. We're working with urban gardeners and urban farmers. We're working with the directors of migrant and deportee shelters. We're working with an intersectional community of influencers in Tijuana as partners in the work of training, right, and helping U.S.-based leaders understand what it means to become everyday peacemakers, especially as it pertains to the migrants who live in our own neighborhoods, but also helping faith leaders understand the implications of our well-intentioned short-term missions in a city like Tijuana.
Yeah.
Right. So as over 6 years, as we've been doing this work, we've been building trust. And when trust happens, so does credibility. And then we get introduced out to more and more people, more of the folks who are building a citywide strategy, you know, who are doing the research on the implications of all these things, who are like Tijuana literally is lead. It might be leading the world, a city leading the world in terms of how do you absorb people on the move, right? Because they're experiencing it on a daily basis. And so these are the people that are our partners. And you're right. When I'm watching the migrant caravan come north, I'm thinking to myself, the United States is not going to have to really deal with these folks. Tijuana is.
He also waded into the ways that our engagement with what some are calling the border crisis exposes who we are as humans, as citizens, as persons of faith.
I would say the people who are engaging in this moment are people who have their roots in American evangelicalism and have become disillusioned by it because they recognize that it doesn't produce what it promises. That the Jesus that they were trained to follow is a Jesus who encourages them to accumulate power, abundance, and safety, and that just doesn't match with what they see of the Jesus in the scriptures. And so the people who are joining us in our work, and I think the folk that we're being a part of training more so than ever before, are people who are disillusioned by what they feel is a bill of goods that's been sold to them. They're interested in exploring a Jesus who puts on display what a cross-wearing, enemy-loving, others-embracing God looks like, and are actually willing to take some steps beyond the incubators of safety toward people who are not like them, and they're finding themselves found and formed by God as they do.
Thank you for listening to this episode, this Season 3 review. And thanks for listening to Season 3 of the At Sea Podcast. Season 4 is right around the corner, and it's going to feature conversations with Aaron Nyquist, Jen Hatmaker, Andrew Osenga, Ephraim Smith, and a truckload of other folks. I'm still building the season, and honestly, I am thrilled. In the coming weeks, not only will I kick off the next season, but I'll share a bit more of what it looks like, what it means to be a patron and a supporter of this podcast. In one way, shape, or form, I look forward to having you join us.